and welcome to another episode of Something Rhymes with Purple. This is a podcast that Susie Dent and I have been doing for, nearly 2 years now. And each week we meet up, now virtually, me in London, she in Oxford, we're broadcasting from the United Kingdom, and we talk about words and language, because we both love words and language. You know that language is power. It's how we communicate, particularly in a world where it's now considered dangerous to hug, to touch one another. How do you communicate? Well, you communicate with words. And so each week we gather to explore words. And we're going to have an episode today where we're going to talk about sex. If you feel, my children like listening to this program, I'm not sure how they... Well, this is our parental advisory warning. We are going to have a no-holds-barred discussion on the etymology, the language. Some of it's slang, some of it is technical, all to do with aspects of sex. So if you think, in fact, what I would advise you to do is if you are adult, listen to this first before you share it with your children. You may feel it's an education for your children. It may even be an education for me. Talking about sex with Susie, I found, is always an education. I think this has come about because we mentioned fornication, didn't we, on our recent pasta episode?
That's right. We were talking about pasta or spaghetti puttanesca, which is in Italian pretty much the prostitutes or the sex workers' spaghetti. And I was talking about fornication and how it is probably linked to fornix in Latin, which meant the arches. And very often bakeries in Roman Britain would be very near arches, apparently. So it was a warm and safe place to stand. And the idea was that the prostitutes would stand near the fornix. And that is where we get fornicate
from. How interesting, near the fornix. So look, we've learnt something in the first minute, which is fantastic. Let's get down to basics and talk about, when we're talking about sex, what is the origin of the word sex? I thought it meant six in Latin.
Oh, yeah. No, the Latin sexus actually first referred to the two genders in those days. So sex entered the language in English, at least in medieval times. And in reference to sexual intercourse, It's only been used really since the early parts of the 20th century. So really recent usage. And you can guess which writer was probably amongst the first to talk about having sex.
Well, was it D.H. Lawrence in the 1920s?
It was D.H. Lawrence. Absolutely. It was
David Herbert Lawrence, playwright, novelist, famous because he wrote Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was a banned book in Britain for many years until about 1960. Sexual intercourse as a phrase is a 20th century turn of phrases.
The use of sex, at least to mean that. So the use of the abbreviation sex and to sex something up, to use it in a kind of metaphorical sense, that's only been around since the 1940s. And then, of course, in 2003, it hit the headlines again. Do you remember when it was claimed that the British government had knowingly sexed up a report on whether Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction? And then people have been described as being sexy since the 1920s, and that was transferred to anything from a kind of remote control flat panel TV to a LBD little black dress. That's the 1950s. So the kind of modern senses really are quite modern. We're talking 20th century for a lot of these.
So sex is short for sexual intercourse, which we sometimes now say, I'm sleeping with someone, meaning I'm having sex with someone. Is sleeping with old as well? As a phrase?
No, I've only just looked this up and I'm really surprised by this. So if you'd asked me just off the cuff, I would have said probably 18th century, maybe at a push. Do you know what? It goes all the way back to Old English and the Anglo-Saxons, sleeping with, implying sexual intimacy or cohabitation, and to sleep around, to engage in sexual intercourse casually with a variety of partners, that is more recent. So that's 1928. The first record that we have is Aldous Huxley, actually. Not him sleeping around, but he's mentioning it in a novel. But yeah, sleeping with, surprisingly early.
It's extraordinary. Well, now we've gone back to that Anglo-Saxon English. Mm. Let's confront the word fuck, because we've touched on it a couple of times. But just remind me of the origin of fuck, because that's the most familiar as it were, slang term for having sex, isn't it?
I mean, I think I said to you before, ask any linguist for the most versatile word in English and fuck would be near the top of the list, really, because you can use it as a noun, I don't give a fuck, an intensifier, not a fucking clue, you know, you can have fuck me shoes, you can be fucked over, you can be a total fuckwit, fuck around, all of that. It is not an acronym for fornication under command of the king. So do you remember that story? So that was it's a lovely myth attached to it. And I get this on Twitter quite a lot. And that is that it comes from a time when the population had been decimated by plague, decimated in its general sense, and the crown therefore ordered its citizens to go forward and procreate. And they were told to hang a sign outside their door, F-U-C-K, fornicating under command of the king, to show others that they should not be disturbed by royal decree. But I'm afraid it is literally fucking nonsense, that one. The answer is far from simple. And in fact, a lot of etymologists will call fuck four letters in search of an etymology because we haven't completely nailed it down. But our best bet is that it is all about hitting. And the very first references to fucking in the OED are not about having sex. It's all about hitting people. And you can find that in surnames like Mr. Fuckbeggar, Mr. Beggar Hitter, who was clearly quite a violent citizen. And you remember a windfucker was an old name for the kestrel because it hits the wind with its wings. And in that case, that would take us back to the Latin pugnare, to hit, which means that fuck and actually pugnacious might share the same ancient root.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And if actually, if we're going to get really, really bad, you know, you mentioned Lady Chatterley's lovers.
Yeah.
You know, in around the 1700s, if fuck was printed at all, it was always F-K. And these dashes and asterisks continued in a pretty recently, in fact, in attempt to avoid any charge of obscenity. And when there was an unsuccessful prosecution in the 60s of Penguin Books for the publication of Lady Chatterley's Lover, the prosecution counsel urged the jury to hold hidden from your wives and servants, this is a rude sentence coming up, a book that contained 30 fucks or fuckings, 14 cunts, 13 balls, 6 each of shit and arse, 4 cocks and 3 piss. That's how rude it was.
Well, that's why I was only 10 or 11 at the time and I was away at prep school. I sent off for a copy.
Did your book in your school intercept it?
They did, but it was returned to me when I left the school. And the spine was broken, so it clearly had been read by the headmaster, by the matron, by the sportsmaster, by everybody, in fact, yes. Have you read it? Have you read Lady Chatterley's Lover?
I read it years ago as well. I'm not as young as you. I think I was in my 20s when I read it. Yeah.
Then there are as you say, the word fuck, there's so many variations of it. I do remember once in the 1960s, I'd never heard this phrase, somebody actually sent me a note saying, do you fancy a buddy fuck?
Oh.
Yes, isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
have you heard of this expression?
Yes. Fuck buddy, I've heard of. I mean, we talk about fuck buddies these days.
Oh, well, maybe I've misremembered this. Maybe that's what it was. Maybe they were offering to be my fuck buddy. How old is that expression?
A fuck buddy. What period was this that somebody
This is in the 1960s in America. This could have been the most exciting part of my gap year, but I didn't seize the moment.
No, you didn't. Well, if they did say this, then they were ahead of the OED, because here the earliest reference we have is 1973.
Well, there you are. So I imagine it was university campus talk in the late 1960s.
Was this a man or a woman?
It was a woman.
Because I think it was sort of, according to this, it says in early use it was particularly gay slang. So I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know.
Oh, well, maybe I've misremembered the whole story, but it was the late 1960s during my gap year. So there you go.
I have a brilliant friend called Jonathan Green. Do you know, have you heard of
Jonathan?
Of course, I
know him.
So Jonathan Green is the slang lexicographer of our time. He has written what has been acknowledged as having written the OED of slang, and it's written with huge authority. It's absolutely brilliant. Anyway, he's written also, or pulled together from his vast database, amazing timelines of words for particular things, from sex to police to death to drugs to being mad to alcohol to, you know, being drunk, etc. And his timelines are extraordinary, because what you do is you just look at a particular subject, and then you can see what people were saying back in, you know, the 1500s, and then trace it all the way up to, or all the way to the current day. And I'm looking at the moment I'm looking at the one for intercourse, which starts 1500, pay a bill at sight, melting moments, to dance the Irish jig, to blow off the loose corns, to thread the needle. This is going right up to the 1800, to be in a woman's beef, to lip one's nags in the gallop. Horizontal polo, that's going right up to the 1900s. And the one you will have heard of, to grope for trout in a peculiar river. I would urge people to look up the timelines of slang because they are absolutely brilliant. Jonathan Green, Jonathan with an O. But it's fascinating to see how we have created both kind of, you know, funny slang, but also real euphemisms for sex since very, very early on.
Alternative words to fuck include things like bonk and boff and bang and shag. What's the origin of shag? Yeah.
Well, shag is a word with lots of meaning. So shag, as in shag pile carpet, which actually has nothing to do with the sexual sense of shag, goes back to an Old English word for rough, matted hair. So no surprise there. It's related to a Viking word meaning a beard. And then you've got the bird that's called a shag, and that's probably because of its shaggy crest. But the sexual intercourse sense is first recorded in the late 1700s, probably goes back even before then. And it probably is related to another verb meaning to shake. So it's simply all about movement, that one. Whereas the sort of boff, boink, bang, bodge thing is all about, you know, onomatopoeia and sound, apparently. I've never actually heard bang, bodge, boink and boff as the sound of sex, but obviously some people did.
Oh, clearly your lovers have all been quiet people.
But no, but actually it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because you just talked about the history of fuck and how it might be related to hitting. All of those too can be used. If you bonk somebody, if you boff somebody, it can also be used for hitting. So that sort of connection is still there.
You slipped boink in there. I mean, I've heard of bonk. I've heard of boff.
I've never heard of boink.
Boink, boink. That's a funny kind of sex. Do you fancy a quick boink?
You're a bit piggy about it.
Yes, that's marvellous. Do you remember those? There were things that you would sort of, big orange things that had ears that you would bounce around on as
space
a child.
Hoppers.
Space hoppers. They go boink, boink. I don't think that's quite what happens. I think we go bonking. We go boffing. We even go banging. I haven't heard about bodging. I think bodging, it must be going wrong. Do you fancy a quick bodge? That doesn't sound that much fun.
I'm going to look up bodge. Now, I've not heard this either, actually. To bodge is to patch or mend clumsily. There's no sexual sense in this, but there might be in Jonathan's dictionary of slang. I'll have to look that one up. But like you, I would definitely not say any of those. And there's things like, there's the real euphemism, making love, isn't there?
Now, this confuses a lot of people because making love, people go to a restoration play and they hear somebody saying, oh, I made love to her. And they think, because they're modern people, oh, they had sex, but they didn't. Making love, up until the 20th century, really, was giving expressions of love.
It was. It was to woo or try to seduce people, wasn't it? And then the sexual sense came in about 1927. Originally US again, to engage in sexual intercourse, especially considered as an act of love. So we've got nookie as well. Nookie's a strange one because
I love the idea of nookie.
It sounds very sweet, doesn't it? But actually, originally, it was offensive.
Do you remember Nookie Bear?
Oh, Nookie Bear.
Nookie Bear was a character that the ventriloquist Roger de Courcy used to have. And the original Nookie Bear is now with my Teddy Bear Museum collection at Newby Hall in Yorkshire. So if you want to go and visit Nookie Bear, he's still there.
Why was he called Nookie?
Well, it was naughty. He was a naughty bear. And Nookie loved a bit of Nookie.
Oh.
When does Nookie come in as a term for sex?
Well, it's related to a nook as in an interior angle that you might find, like a corner or a recess in a room. That's where we think it comes. And you've got ingle, nook, etc. But nookie first referred to a woman considered as a sexual object. So it was pretty offensive. 1928 was that one. And then very soon after it began to refer to sex. But you'll see from this one, this is from a novel in 1930, you'll see that it's still pretty sexist. Hendrick said he'd picked up with a skirt that was a warm baby and he was getting his nookie every night. So just to call the woman a skirt is, you know, tells it.
But it's interesting, these new terms and this language seems to be mostly 100 years old. We're celebrating, this is coming in the 1920s. All the people who've mentioned, Aldous Huxley, D.H. Lawrence, this last example, these are all late 1920s. There are older terms like copulate,
Yes,
that have been around.
Straight Latin. Coitus also, that is straight Latin. That simply means bringing together. They all mean bringing together and completing, really.
Like to consummate our union?
Yes, same thing.
So it's interesting we use the term making love because, of course, much of what we're describing is making lust, or rather the act of lust, rather than necessarily an act of love. Is there a heritage that's interesting of love versus lust?
Well, love is from a really ancient root, as you would expect. And that also gave us the German Liebe, and it gave us libido. And it also gave us leave, as in to take leave if you were a soldier, because it was all about trust, really. The real Ur root of this, the original root, was all about giving someone permission because you trusted them. So furlough, believe it or not, goes back to the same root, furlough being a word that we've heard of so much this year. So love is related to Liebe, it's related to libido, and lust, simply, if you say in German, ich habe Lust auf whatever, that just means I would like something, I want something. So Lust means desire, but in German it can mean all sorts of different things. And if something is lustig, it's funny, because it's desirable, because it's funny and makes you laugh. So lots and lots of siblings along the way.
Very good. Are you in favour of love and lust, or lust without love? Do you take a position on this?
That's a very deep, deep question. I think there's room for both, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, it's best when they come together.
Well, of course.
Speaking of which, coming together. Yes, oh, that's really good. We're steering clear of any kind of obvious
vulgarity. You're back to the groping for trout in a peculiar river. And actually, do you know, that was a Shakespearean one, From Measure to Measure. Do you know that one?
Measure for Measure. It's actually a very grim play.
Is
because
it?
Yes, it basically involves, well, rape. It involves corruption in high places and taking physical advantage. It's a tough play on sexual relationships. Completely fascinating. Shakespeare has a whole range, doesn't he, of euphemisms. I mean, my favourite is making the beast with two backs, which I know...
That's Othello, isn't it?
Yeah, that is Othello. And Othello is full of the most amazing animal imagery of a sexual nature. And in Act 1, Scene 1, Brabantio asks Iago, "What profane wretch art thou?" And Iago responds, "I am one, sir, that comes to tell you your daughter and the Moor are now making the beast with two backs." Mm. And that is because he's saying that Desdemona, who's the daughter of Brabantio, and the Moor of Venice, the great leader, military leader Othello, are, well, in fact, they've got married. And it's a very vivid image, isn't it? If you see an animal with two backs, because obviously they are doing it traditionally in the what is known as the missionary position. How old is the missionary position as an expression?
The missionary, isn't that strange, the missionary position? I've always found it very, very odd, even having gone to a convent. I'll look it up and see. I hope that the editor of the OED is not currently looking up my search history, but he's probably used to it, to be honest. Right. 1929.
It's all in the 1920s. Isn't this interesting?
It says sexual life. Oh, gosh, this is awful. Totally imperialistic. But it's obviously a chronicle. It says the sexual life of savages. Isn't that awful? And it says the natives despise the European position and consider it unpractical and improper. So that is obviously they're talking about the missionary position here.
But how interesting that people regarded it as improper and was it unsaid and impractical?
Impractical. But so 1920s, you're right. There is definitely a kind of timeline going on here, isn't there? I mean, there are some others that are probably around the same time. So, and quite often they are quite sexist. So a bit of Crumpet, for example, or a bit of How's Your Father?
Oh, yes, a bit of How's Your Father.
Hanky panky.
Do you fancy a bit of, slap and tickle, a bit of Crumpet, a bit of How's Your Father?
Yeah, Crumpet's not, Crumpet derives from a really misogynistic view of a woman. So it was women regarded collectively as a means of sexual gratification. And
but
then
we love Crumpet. Don't you love a Crumpet?
Well, I do love a crumpet, but not in the sense that whereas it's dismissing women. But
no, of course not.
So that, and then How's Your Father? That sounds to me a little bit like the sort of Victorian euphemisms for trousers. Do you remember those? My sit upons and my unmentionables, my inexpressibles, my round me houses. Oh, that's 1968. Now you will like this actually, Giles, because Alan Corrin is the first record in the OED in Punch. If you're after a bit of How's Your Father, he said evilly, you can't go wrong with Torremolinos.
He was a very witty writer. Anybody wants to enjoy good comic writing, look up the works of Alan Corran, the father, incidentally, of Giles Corran and Victoria Corran Mitchell, as she now is. And I'm proud to say he was a friend of mine years ago. Now, look, there are other euphemisms. Let's just rattle through a few euphemisms before we take a break. Some of us may need to go and lie down. Shaking of the sheets without music.
Yes, that's medieval, that one. That goes back to the Middle Ages. Really? I think so, yeah. There apparently was a dance of the time called that, but the bit in brackets was kind of, you know, nod, nod, wink, wink thing, the innuendo. In fact, innuendo, just to let you know, goes back to the Latin nuere, meaning to nod, because you're nodding in the direction of something rather than actually saying it out loud.
Ah, so shaking of the sheets, brackets without music. So when you were shaking of the sheets, that's a fun thing to do. And of course, it's actually as the sheets go up and down. Boom, 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 boom. And
speak for yourself.
Yeah, well, it rather dates me when there were sheets.
Oh, that's true. It's been a long time.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it has been. It has
shaking of the duvets.
But can I say, it's easier to talk about than to do at my age. Dancing the Paphian jig.
Yes, so Paphos on Cyprus was sacred to Aphrodite, and Aphrodite was the goddess of sex and love who gave us aphrodisiac, whereas Venus, unfortunately for her, gave us venereal disease.
Oh, of course it did. Well, there's another one, to wind somebody's little ball of yarn. Have you heard of that one?
Well, that one apparently featured in a 19th century folk song where the singer asks a pretty girl if he can wind up her little ball of yarn, which is just one of the worst euphemisms I've ever heard. But yes, it's slightly menacing, that one, I would say. But yeah, I've never heard that one. I don't think that one's used these days. I've heard things like horizontal refreshment, rumpy pumpy.
I like
pumpy.
That one. Don't you quite like that one? Horizontal refreshment?
I guess so. Rumpy pumpy is another one, isn't it? That sounds like real carry on to me.
Let's have a bit of rumpy pumpy.
Sid James.
It's a fun idea, isn't it? Oh, dear. What about rogering? Oh, yes.
Poor Roger.
Poor Roger. As you know, the advertisement for Viagra that says, take Viagra. It won't make you Sean Connery, but it might make you Roger Moore.
So Roger was an old word for a penis, a bit like Johnson, really. Was coarse slang, as it said in the OED. That goes back to, so many different words for this, but 1644. Good grief. And perhaps Sir Roger follows Mrs. Bride to her apartment where he uses pungent and pressing arguments. Ooh, that's from 1679. And then rogering, meaning having sex, well, usually of a man at least, is from 1600s again. Yeah, the master rogered such a one. So why poor Roger was chosen for this, I'm not sure. But the word again, like fuck, was sometimes written with asterisks and dashes to avoid the charge of obscenity.
What I think is interesting about all this, Susie, it's one of the reasons that etymology is so fascinating, is that whether we like the terms or like the way they were used or not, they are history. They tell us a lot about people's attitudes to different subjects, don't they? And we're learning a lot about people's views of sex and relationships in these words. What about see a man about a dog?
Well, see a man about the dog, I have never, ever heard in the context of having sex. I've always heard it in terms of needing the loo. There's a brilliant sketch with the Monty Python people for, which went out in our euphemisms episode, which Purple People can find again in our archive. They talk about all sorts of euphemisms for going to the loo. And the one that sticks at the end was visiting the donut in Granny's greenhouse. But they mentioned seeing a man about a dog.
Visiting the donut in Granny's greenhouse. Oh, yes. I love it. Oh.
But I am going to look up now seeing a man about a dog, and I've never heard it ever in terms of small sex, but you obviously have.
Okay. While you look that one up, let's take a quick break. We've got a Viagra advertisement coming up.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered, but we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm La La La, Let Me Explain, and this is It's Not You, It's Them, But It Might Be You. I'm here to answer all your questions around love, relationships, sex, dating dilemmas, and anything else you throw my way. Join me 3 times a week as we work through the depths of this intimacy pool together. From Sony Music Entertainment, listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Something Rhymes with Purple, where we are talking the language of sex. And I think the last thing that Giles mentioned, Giles Brander, sitting opposite me by Zoom anyway, was Viagra. I think that, I'm not sure this is completely true, but I've heard that that, Giles, comes from, the word Viagra comes from Sanskrit for tiger. Not sure if that's true or not.
As in put a tiger in your tank. Maybe, because that was a famous advertisement once upon a time.
That was for petrol, wasn't it?
It was, but the phrase was put a tiger in your tank, and maybe that's what Viagra is supposed to do.
I have no idea. I think Viagra comes after that. But is it true that Viagra was first intended for use as a, was it heart medicine? But its side effect was the one that people enjoyed the most. So they switched its application. Is that true?
I've no idea. I'm not a student of Viagra. As you know from my our episode on lotions and potions, I try to avoid all pills of every kind.
Yeah.
So, go to see a man about a dog. What's the origin of that?
Okay, so going to see a man about the dog, it seems that it can be used as a euphemism for all sorts of things. So you might, you know, where you don't want to sort of say out loud where you're going and what your destination is. So you might then say you want to go to the loo and you'll use it that way. Apparently Donald Trump used it on The Apprentice and of course then claimed to have coined it because he has all the words. But yes, it's an undisclosed appointment. And so it can be, I think it's more often used for the loo. I think I was right there. But if you want to use it about sex, that's absolutely fine with me. But not with me, obviously.
Well, I think that's all we need to talk about sex for today. If you've got queries or questions of a sexual nature that you want to share with us, Susie will do her best to give you the benefit of her wisdom. And get in touch with us. It's purple@somethingelse.com. Something without a G.
Yes, we didn't even talk about jiggery-pokery.
Didn't we talk about jiggery-pokery?
We didn't talk about jiggery-pokery. We'll do that next time.
Fancy a bit of the other? There's so many. But it's because it's a fundamental thing, sex.
Yes.
That's why.
Of course it is. Of course.
I mean, you know, we could do loads of episodes about sex and about death.
We did do a show on death, but I think it was mostly to do with, you know, as I say, the sanitization of it. So in a way, it's nice that we don't sanitize sex all the time, because as you say, it is fundamental. And I think people speak much more freely about it these days, which is only a good thing.
Is it only a good thing? Or is there...
You think the romance has been taken out of it?
Well, I wonder also if reticence isn't quite nice at times, being too upfront about things. I also, I have to say, we've used the F-bomb endlessly here today, but I hope we did give a health warning at the beginning, because I know there are some people who don't like these words. Mm. And I've occasionally been... I travel on the bus a lot, not so much at the moment, but I used to travel all the time on the bus. And occasionally I'd be sitting with some older people and there'd be some younger people on the bus using F words, C words, bad language.
Yeah.
And I know I could sense with some of the people near me, they found it uncomfortable.
I think it's because it can come across as being quite aggressive. Mm. So I think I totally understand that, because I think if they're just throwing it in for effect or in a sort of lazy way, I'm with you. I don't really like it either. For me, a good swear is one that you do for yourself. You know, I've often talked about lalokisia, that relief of stress and frustration, etc. And for me, it's very much a kind of self-utilizing thing. I don't use it to kind of make myself sound clever or whatever. And if you hear kids coming out of a secondary school, I wince as well, because they just think, oh, come on, you know, you don't have to do this. Yeah. So I think spare it for the proper occasion. That's what I would say.
Well, fuck me, Susie. We've almost run out of time and we haven't dealt with people's questions this week. And we've got lots of people getting in touch with us. Whose letter do you want to share with us first?
Well, we have a nice email from Mark Bielas, who thanks us for the podcast, Giles, because he said it injects some excitement into the long COVID weeks, which is lovely to hear. And he asked if we could discuss the origin and usage of words that generalise an item like gadget, gizmo, thing and widget. And I think I've talked about thing before, because it started off meaning something so important in languages like Icelandic and Scandinavian languages, where thing was an assembly of really important people where you would discuss a very essential issue of the day. And you still have the Althing in Iceland, which is the parliament. But thing for us has gradually declined over the years and the centuries to mean literally anything. It's just kind of catch-all, isn't it? Which I think is quite sad.
Though, interestingly, to interrupt you, is that a thing is now an expression that people use. And that's almost elevating it back to where it was. Is that a thing? Meaning, is that something important?
A lovely observation. Yeah, that's a lovely observation, actually. Quite right. It will be interesting to see if it goes back the other way. So I'm going to start with gizmo. 1940s, we genuinely don't know where that one comes from. We do know that sailors were the first people to talk about gadgets. And the word started out in nautical slang, and there already it was a general term for any small device or mechanism or part of a ship. You remember that the word gremlin began in the RAF with pilots who would use a gremlin for any kind of mechanical malfunction. So gadget is doing pretty much the same thing. It's a catch-all for any small mechanism. 1886 is the first recorded use we have. And they refer to lots of other things, actually. I'll read you the quote. Then the names of all the other things on board a ship. I don't know half of them yet. This is from a nautical log. Even the sailors forget at times. And if the exact name of anything they want happens to slip from their memory, they call it a chicken fixing or a gadget or a gilguy or a timinoggy or a whimwham. So it may come from gâchette, which in French is a lock mechanism, or they also have a gâchet for a tool. So it might come from there. Widget is an alteration of a gadget. So it began meaning a small gadget, a weeny gadget. It then, do you remember, it became this device used in beer cans to give beer a creamy head because it introduced some sort of nitrogen into it. That was the widget. So there you go. Yeah, look, we have so many of those. Ask anyone what they call the remote control and most people will have a different answer. Their families.
We may have to have a whole gadget gizmo widget episode. Here's a letter from Jean Shute in Auckland, New Zealand. Mm-hmm. I love the way people listen to this program all over the world. Thank you for being with us. I was rereading an old favorite novel and came across a phrase used by an elderly character who said, "I felt it in my waters." I understand the meaning. I think it's similar to "I felt it in my bones." But why waters? What waters? Do you have any idea of the origin of the phrase? I've noticed it's often used by older women.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it could refer to the sort of fluids in our body. You know, there's so many references to that. Do you remember hysterical goes back to the idea of a floating uterus, one that wasn't in its correct place. The Greek for a womb was hysterus or hystera. And so the idea was that you were hysterical if your uterus wasn't quite, you know, it was floating around. So it may refer to the waters of the body. And if you look it up, to feel something in ones. There are lots of different variations. One of them was the marrow, to feel something in one's marrow. So the tissue of your bones, which are really sensitive to extremes of heat and cold and that kind of thing. And with all of these, the idea is it's the innermost part of your being.
Well, staying anatomical, just time for one more communication from Marjorie Critch-Hyam. And she's one of our regular listeners. And she says, "Hello, Susie and Charles. While cutting across a park field with our beautiful dog, Bonnie, my husband and I both said, 'Keep your eyes peeled.' Oof. We were desperate to avoid dog poo. I'd love to know why we use the word peeled."
This one has always, always got to me. It just makes me squirm even saying it because I'm just very weird about my eyes. Well, this one too has got many variants on it. It goes back to 1844, the first record we have. So not too old, this one. But one of the variants that it was riffing off is to keep one's eyes skinned, which is even worse. I know, awful. But the idea is that you remove any barrier so that you absolutely keep a very, very close lookout for whatever it is that needs to be found.
Well, I keep a close lookout every week for your trio, the three words that I want to put into my vocabulary. And I've discovered the only way to make this work is to write the words down when you say them and then to try to use them during the week. Otherwise, they just slip from the memory. So tell me, what are the three words I've got to write down this week and why?
Okay, well, one I just think is always nice to remember, and it's just a very pithy way of describing somebody who deserves credit or gratitude. And there are so many individuals that, you know, wow, this year are really deserving of both of those things. And that's simply thankworthy.
Oh.
So to say a thankworthy individual, yeah, it's just really pithy. I mean, you understand it completely, immediately, but you know, it's good, isn't it? This other one, I suppose, is slightly in keeping. Concupiscence.
Oh.
Concupiscence.
I'd say it concupiscence.
Oh, there you go. Concupiscence. But, spell it for me, Jazz. This is a challenge for you.
Oh, con, C-O-N.
Yeah.
Q, Q, C-U-P.
Mm-hmm.
I.
Mm-hmm.
S-E-N-C-E.
It's S-C-E-N-C-E. So you just missed out the C, but very, very good.
And no, it simply means wrong.
It simply means having the hots.
Oh.
So it's lust, really. To concupiscere in Latin meant to desire vehemently or ardently. So that's what it is. It's an old, slightly masked way of saying lust.
Ooh.
And what else was the last one? Well, I think this applies to me sometimes, actually. Not very sexy in the context of what we're talking about today. So try not to be a microlipid. M-I-C-R-O-L-I-P-E-T. A microlipid is somebody who gets all worked up about trivial things.
Oh, a microlipid. Well, that could apply to sex, couldn't it? All worked up about trivial things. Oh, for goodness sake. What was all the fuss about, mate? I'm a natural microlipid. I like it.
Yes.
There was concupiscence from him, but you were the microlipid. Yes, well, he's certainly not thankworthy. That's the way to use it. I think what one should do is take the three words and try and work them into a story or a sentence if you want to remember them. Every week on Something Rhymes with Purple, we get a treat. A trio from Susie Dent, new words to enhance your life. And this Christmas, if you want to give a present to somebody, I recommend her book. It's called Word Perfect, and it's got an interesting word for every day of the year. I'm going to finish with a little poem written by a friend of mine, and it's got, I felt it was an appropriate poem for this week. It's a limerick. It's a limerick about language.
Okay.
And you know how some words sound so similar but actually have different meanings? This is by my friend Mike Plum, who is one of the leading lights in the Queen's English Society. You lied, or you lay, or you laid. Let me speedily come to your aid. You laid tables and plans, lay in bed or on sands, and you lied about having got laid.
Thank you so much for listening. We hope you managed to get through it with a smile on your face. Do let us know, and obviously let us know if there are any themes that you would like us to touch on, actually, or any subjects that we haven't covered yet. The email is purple@somethingelse.com. Something Rhymes with Purple is a Something Else production, produced by Lawrence Bassett, with additional production from Harriet Wells, Steve Ackerman, Ella McLeod, Jay Beale, and, well, I just refer you to those timelines I was talking about earlier. It's Gully.
He's thankworthy.
Oh, he is always.